WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Hollywood, the bizarre world of filmmaking. We talk with a producer and a writer who both have their share of stories about the industry. Linda Obst is a producer whose films include Sleepless in Seattle and The Fisher King. Her new memoir is Hello, He Lied. Bruce Wagner grew up in Hollywood. He wrote the script for the TV series Wild Palms and the film Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. His new novel about people on the fringes of the movie business is I'm Losing You. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews First Band on the Moon by the Swedish group The Cardigans. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. It's another day of hectic campaigning for Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole. He's crisscrossing the country ahead of tomorrow's general election, NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports.
After spending the day in California yesterday, Dole flew to Phoenix, Arizona early this morning for a 5 a.m. visit to a local diner. Inside, Dole asked for ginger tea to soothe his hoarse voice. Later, he addressed the cheering crowd outside. Dole smiled and looked energetic and refreshed, perhaps from a few hours' break on the flight in. He told supporters that he believes the polls are moving in his direction and, quote, that the undecided voters are coming our way. He told Perot supporters that a vote for Perot is a vote for Bill Clinton and that if they don't want Bill Clinton, they should vote for him, Bob Dole. With the Dole campaign in Alamogordo, New Mexico, I'm Chitra Raghavan.
Meanwhile, President Clinton opened what he called the last day of his last campaign in Manchester, New Hampshire. The state holds good memories for the president. It's where he dubbed himself the Comeback Kid.
I said in Dover, New Hampshire in 1992, that if you would give me a chance to be president, I would be with you till the last dog dies. Well, folks, there's a lot of life left in this old dog.
Mr. Clinton will stop in 5 states today. His eventual goal is Little Rock, Arkansas, by tomorrow morning. Reform Party candidate Ross Perot spent some of his last campaign hours in the television studio preparing 4 half-hour-long infomercials that will air today. He does plan to make one campaign appearance before the polls open tomorrow. He'll speak at St. Mary's University in San Antonio today. British Telecommunications and MCI are touting their planned $21 billion merger as a boon for consumers and businesses. Larry Matthews has more.
British Telecom is Britain's largest telephone company. MCI is the second largest long-distance company in the United States. Together, the two companies are valued at $54 billion and will become a giant global telecommunications force. Regulators in the United States, Britain, and the European Union must approve the deal. AT&T is already claiming the merger will hurt competition and reduce customer choice. AT&T Chairman Robert Allen wants regulators to take a close look at the terms of the merger and what it will mean for other companies, particularly AT&T, which stands to lose the most. AT&T wants regulators to condition approval on a loosening of competition in the British telecommunications market. For its part, the Washington-based MCI says the merger will mean lower long-distance rates all around the world. I'm Larry Matthews in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 12 points at 6033. The Nasdaq is down a point at 1220. This is NPR. The Pentagon says for the second time in 3 days, a U.S. fighter pilot launched a missile at an Iraqi anti-aircraft site. The Pentagon says Iraqi radar had locked onto his plane. This latest incident occurred before dawn in the Iraqi desert, about 25 miles from where the earlier firing took place. This pilot returned safely to base as well. A review of the Saturday missile firing found there was apparently no attempt to target the U.S. fighter plane, but the Pentagon says the pilot's cockpit instruments had indicated he was being targeted and that the pilot responded appropriately. Thousands of U.S. and Japanese troops have begun 2 weeks of joint military exercises. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
10,000 Japanese self-defense forces and 12,000 members of the U.S. military are conducting live ammunition drills and naval exercises in waters off Japan. The maneuvers coincide with joint exercises between American and South Korean troops underway on the peninsula. Seoul implored Washington to join after troops from a North Korean submarine infiltrated the South in September. The aircraft carrier USS Independence is participating in the exercises, cruising waters 90 miles from the North Korean coast. The carrier is the flagship for the U.S. forward-deployed forces based in Yokosuka, Japan, and will join the Japanese exercises. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
An American heart specialist is meeting with Russian doctors today to set a date for President Boris Yeltsin's heart surgery. Dr. Michael DeBakey has said the triple or quadruple heart bypass operation could be done this week, but the Interfax news agency reports Yeltsin's spokesman has declined to comment on the date. He'll only say Yeltsin will be moved to a hospital at least a day before the operation. The doctors say the bypass will likely take 6 to 8 hours and that Yeltsin faces no more risk than the average patient, whose success rate is above 95%. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. This year, two new books share Hollywood as their setting and subject. Linda Obst is the head of Linda Obst Productions. She's written an account of her ascent in Hollywood, from lowly development assistant to the producer of The Fisher King and Sleepless in Seattle. Her book, Hello, He Lied, includes tips on how to pitch an idea, win a bidding war over a hot script, and above all, how to lie and be lied to gracefully. Bruce Wagner grew up in Beverly Hills. He's the author of the novel Force Majeure, as well as the screenplays for scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and the TV miniseries Wild Palms. His new novel, I'm Losing You, presents an L.A. so seedy it couldn't possibly be real, or is it? We thought it might be fun to bring Linda Obst and Bruce Wagner together in our studio to talk about their versions of life in Hollywood. We started the conversation talking about how so many film projects in Hollywood go so wrong, that one film will have as many as 12 different writers on a script. Linda says this is a bad omen.
And the kinds of movies that I make, when I make a good movie, pretty much I have the same writer from the beginning all the way through. It's because I tend to make smaller, less franchise-oriented movies, character-based movies, where the writer's actually the source of the piece. In The Fisher King, the idea of replacing Richard LeGravenais was silly. He was truly its source. The same thing with the writer on One Fine Day. I can always sort of evaluate how the trajectory of a project by the likeliness of not having to replace the writers.
I think paradoxically, though, the further you get away from an original draft, the closer you approach high art.
And this is a high paradox.
Well, what I think all of us lay people watching movies can't believe are situations such as with the movie Mission Impossible. Mm-hmm. I read that they were writing scenes as they were acting them, practically. And as I was watching mm-hmm. the movie, I thought, this makes no sense. This movie makes no sense at a certain mm-hmm. point. And it seemed as if that's exactly what happened. Writers get called in. The movie's being made yeah. without a script. No one knows. The doesn't know what the left hand is doing.
I happen to have written that script. And I'm really resentful. I was actually replaced by Richard LeGravenais. I'm not opposed to, when I was doing Wild Palms, I was writing on set. I think it depends. There's either, if that can sometimes come from a chaotic place, but then look at Mike Lee, who's been canonized for, having virtually no script at all. Mm-hmm. I know that's an exaggerated way of putting it because he does this endless preparation with his actors. But if it comes from an authentic place, I don't think there's a problem with writing on a set. I think the problem comes when it's anarchy and, when, as Linda said, movies are pre-sold and the scripts simply aren't there. And so they're hustling to write, to fulfill their shooting day.
Mm-hmm. And that's the case. Mission Impossible is a classic genre case in which it was already scheduled for its very important slot. As we saw, it dominated the beginning of the summer. It was starring Tom Cruise. It had to be completed within a period of time that he was available. It was a television show. It had a theme song that could be pre-sold and trailers that everybody knew.
Bump, 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 bump. Do you want me to do that while you talk?
Please, Bruce, do that. No, in fact,
so I guess you're saying, who cares about the script?
Well, the script was the last factor in greenlighting the movie. The concept and the actor and the genre got greenlit. And then, oops, it's 4 weeks from production and we need to get a script here. And that's how professional rewrite guys get very, very rich.
Now, I liked that film. I hoped to work with all those people. I would never say anything against De Palma or Tom or Robert Towne, who worked on the film. So I thought it was quite marvelous. And
Bruce?
I hope that they helped me with my dreams and visions.
I'm going to have to put you in the corner now and talk to Linda a little bit.
You know, Bruce has a tremendous quality of charm that has advanced him enormously in the movie industry. When you're able to please the powers that be to the degree that Bruce is, you just work constantly, frankly.
And it's his career show. Now, Linda, you did write in your book, though, that the writers are usually the least charming of the players around the pitch table.
Well, I always thought that that the talent of a writer was an inverse proportion to his ability to pitch. The better the writer, the lousier the pitch. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. The process of really writing is, of course, not thinking from the outside in the way a producer does, the way an executive does, where you're cloning concepts and you're hybriding notions. I mean, writers actually think about characters, you know, and they actually don't know the entire trajectory of a screenplay before they begin. And it's very hard for them to encapsulate because they actually, you know, feel what they're thinking. And I always was suspicious of a writer that pitched too well. It was sort of producer think, or that writer was in fact a director-to-be, had so much control and charm that it was a temporary way station in the home of writerland. And in fact, he was on his way to being a director.
I'm thinking of a odd story you tell about a pitch you were making to David Geffen. You were pitching a David Mamet screenplay, and you were putting your heart and your soul into it, and he's reading a newspaper while you're talking. And you made your point, you come to a full stop, and he looks up and he says what to you?
You know, Linda, if you got collagen shots, you could be very attractive. Now, the thing is, David's not really happy with the story, but the thing is that you have to sort of know David to know that there was some way in which David thought he was being helpful with that remark. Because doesn't David give sort of beauty advice to almost everyone that works with
It's sort of
an
Andy Warholian comment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I love David,
mm-hmm.
and would like to work with him. He's always been very kind to me.
Would you like to give your phone number now?
Now,
what do you
funny.
Mean he's trying to
but
help
you, know,
you?
Well, there are two things. I mean, I felt at the time there was a tactical, strategic aspect to what David was doing, which he's subsequently denied, but I continue to think is probably the case, which is he didn't want to answer me. He didn't want to have to deal with my passionate pitch. He had his own information he wanted to gather. He didn't want to say no. He didn't want to say yes. He wanted to keep what I call the decision on the roof. He wanted to delay it. And so a way to delay it was to knock me off my chair by changing the topic and putting the attention on me. I thought it was tactical. He, in fact, thought it was, you know, a tip for my social life.
Ironically, I've had a lot of collagen work since my book came out. And it's really helped me. So
David felt that I should have an extraordinary social life as an accoutrement to my career. And I used to feel like I was disappointing him a little by sort of going home at night and taking care of my son. And I think to a certain extent, he would have loved if I was the most glamorous deity around town and didn't spend all this time pitching difficult movies to make. But the truth is, you know, either David was being tactical or David was giving aesthetic advice. He would say he was giving aesthetic advice, and I would say he was being tactical.
And so all of you walk around every day, every hour, trying to figure out if people are giving aesthetic advice or being tactical or lying?
Well,
or
kind of, yeah. I mean, that's
don't you think
much
that's a good way to live?
It's so relaxed, Barbara, don't you think?
What was
it's
I
really,
thinking?
It's really relaxed. I mean, you really wake up and you recognize that you're in a net of other people's strategies, whether you choose to illuminate them and be aware of them or not, then, of course, you can become completely paranoid and think there are strategies at play when, in fact, you know, you just have to go to the cleaners.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how I interpreted my reviews. it was either tactical or cosmetic. I had to come up, I had to answer that myself.
I think there's a there's actually an interesting juncture in Bruce's book between the tactical and the cosmetic. You have a character who lives at the juncture of tactical and cosmetic, I believe, a skin doctor.
Wow.
Giving collagen shots.
No? Right, whose license plate is less is more.
Yeah, which I actually kind of stole that from Wes Craven, whose license plate is Wes is more.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you do wind up stealing everything.
But it is
which
exhausting.
Is okay, right?
Well, no, it's with my books, the two books that I've written, there's always a flurry at first of people that feel that it's a Roman clay and all that. I mean, for me, I grew up here, so this Los Angeles is a kind of surreal studio backlot. When I was a kid, I lived next door to Broderick Crawford. And I was kind of introduced to Hollywood Babylon early on. His wife, or the woman he was living with, overdosed and died. And I think I was around 11 years old. And this was a neighborhood where I would walk up the street to buy Variety for my father, and there would be Groucho Marx. And I would go to school with Liz Taylor's kids, and there was even a boy that was on Daniel Boone, the TV show, who would come to school late in costume with hair down to his waist. I mean, you know, that it was a very peculiar.
Sideshow.
Yes, yeah. It was a very odd world for me. So that I included real people in my book because I didn't want to resort to any kind of Harold Robbins-like tactics of inventing names that sounded like, you know, a Brad Pitt character. Mm-hmm. So I actually put real people in there. And, you know, because L.A. is a place where you're next to Leonard Nimoy at the car wash. I mean, that's the way this town is. It's a company town. The one thing I love about L.A. is the L.A. Times constantly has obituaries about silent film stars. I just am so moved by that. Mm-hmm. So I put real people in the book and had them talk extensively rather than just doing cameos. You know, I brushed past Sybil Shepherd as I entered Barney's New York, you know. back to the question of whether things are stolen, you know, a writer uses what is in the world around him, just as Linda gets fired up on projects because she catches something of the zeitgeist, you know.
Bruce Wagner and Linda Obst are my guests. Linda is the head of Linda Obst Productions. Her new book about life in Hollywood is Hello, He Lied. Bruce Wagner is a novelist and screenwriter. His new novel is I'm Losing You. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film producer Linda Obst and screenwriter and novelist Bruce Wagner. Well, Bruce, since you opened the Pandora's box of your childhood, if I could ask you a few questions about that. You dropped out of school at 16, right? Mm-hmm. You had some odd jobs and you eventually moved away from L.A.
Yeah.
Did you feel you had to escape that chaos that you were describing?
Oh, no. I think that I was almost sort of unconscious. I left Beverly Hills High School when I was 16, and I started working in a bookstore in Century City, and my friends used to come in, and they would see me behind the counter who hadn't known that I dropped out, and they would think it was some sort of early Andy Kaufman-like practical joke. You know, we used to work as a busboy at a restaurant on weekends or something. And then I simply sort of turned off and left. And I did drive ambulances and drive limousines, I guess sort of gestated as a writer. I think I was always attracted to prose. I'm kind of generationally, I'm caught between prose and movies. I have a weird, almost fetishistic interest in words and books. And yet at the same time, I have it's very odd to me that I'm actually writing prose. It feels out of body. And it's the same with movies. I have a very strong, almost fetish-like attachment to film, and yet it doesn't feel right writing screenplays. So I'm sort of in between, and only the counsel of Linda Obst and I think a few more years of college and therapy will pull me out of this.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because your books are a parody of Hollywood life and Hollywood culture in some sense, but the parody seems so close to home that it could actually happen.
I don't consider my books to be parodies at all. I don't see them even as satirical. Mm-hmm. I think that I leave that to other people. There's a lot of books that come out every year that do high parody of people in Hollywood. I don't think my books should be read as exaggerations in any way.
So this is it.
Yeah, I write, the thing that I'm committed to is writing realistically and ultimately moving people. I want to transcend the Hollywood genre. You know, my beacon is someone like Dickens. While I might never get close to Dickens, he's really the lighthouse. So I'm not interested in creating dark satires of this town. I'm interested in really more in melodrama and narrative than I am in parody.
This town is a dark satire of itself.
Well, let's try some of your dark melodramas out on Linda, okay? You have a character in your book who's a one-time gag writer for Bob Hope, and you have him waiting around at home for about 15 years to hear back from a studio about an adaptation of Gogol's Dead Souls that he submitted decades ago. Mm-hmm. He also listens he listens to cell phone conversations most of the day, I guess, trying to gain info on what's going on in Hollywood. Linda, does this sound like people you'd know?
I know him. I know him. Fortunately, I did not sleep with him, but I know him. And in fact, I was telling Bruce that part of the book knocked me out, because when I lived the house before I live right now, there was a gentleman who lived next door to me who, unbeknownst to me, had been a screenwriter in the 30s, a rather successful screenwriter in the 30s. Apparently for the ensuing 40 years or 50 years, he was selling real estate. But because I moved next door to him and I was buying screenplays, gradually, week after week, I would find more and more screenplays sitting on my front stoop. I read the first one. It was horrible. I pretended I didn't receive it. I left it on my front stoop, and they would pile up, and I got a little nervous because I realized there was a man living next door who decided that his dreams, and as he's a writer like Bruce, so he had dreams, he dreamt.
Vision.
His vision, his entire career depended on whether or not I was going to pick up that screenplay and read it. And it made me very, very jumpy because I wasn't going to pick up that screenplay and make all of his dreams come true. And the day I finished reading Bruce's book, I hadn't seen this man for 7 years. The day I finished reading Bruce's book, I found him at a health food store staring at me, and I realized, my God, he's probably been listening to my cell phone conversations for the past 7 years. There are so many has-beens, never-has-beens, almost was, people attached to the idea of fame, people attached to the patina of a lost fame that might have never even have been. It gives the place a kind of melancholy, a kind of sadness, and frankly, a kind of scariness at its edges that I think, you know, makes it very clear to me that Bruce's work, and this character in particular, is not satire.
I want to try another one of Bruce's fictions, so-called fictions, out on you. Here, give the thumbs up or thumbs down on this pitch. And this comes from Bruce's book. It's a passion of one of his characters. An Anne Sexton biography starring Emma Thompson. Kind of a cross between a female Carrington and Sense and Sensibility.
I'm there. That's a classic project you would pitch to me, Bruce, isn't it? That is the perfect fuzzy girl project. First of all, you say Emma Thompson, right? So we're half there, you know. It's got to be a little bit respectable. It's got a little literary merit in there someplace. We've packaged that bullseye with the movie star who can actually write it as well.
And it's got that indie fuzzy feeling.
It does have an indie fuzzy feeling.
Wow. Well, can we patch in? Who would be right for this? Can we just patch an executive in? Sell this during the program?
I think we could call Lindsay or Amy Pascal right this moment and set this project up. Bruce's pitches are impeccable. And, you know, are they parody? No, they're just sort of sound-alike versions of exactly what we do all day long.
You were just talking about indie fuzzies. Let's talk about the Hollywood lingo I find fascinating. You said, Linda, you wrote in your book that when you arrived in Hollywood, and you arrived because your husband had a job, your husband was a well-known...
He dragged me kicking and screaming, yes.
...agent for writers. And you end up in town, and Peter Gruber of Casablanca Films is inviting you to come be one of his D-girls.
Right.
What is a D-girl?
A D-girl, a development girl. D stands for development. In those days, by the way, we were in charge of creative affairs, which I found probably one of the most erotically charged titles anyone coming from the New York Times, you can imagine the humor and the self-parody of a title called Director of Creative Affairs. It's since been called D-Girls. And D-Girls in those days, well, it's similar, although D-Girls have more efficacy now than they used to. In those days, they were there merely to prepare notes for the boss, to attend meetings and keep track of things that were said, to make their boss look good, to manifest opinions that the boss would actually articulate, and to, as I say, dispense exotic bottled water. But in no way was the D-girl in the room to actually develop the project herself or ultimately get it made. She was there, I say, as a sort of gracious second wife, as someone whose job it was to make the boss who didn't read the script and who wasn't prepared for the meeting look good in that meeting.
God, I kind of want to be a D-girl.
It's, you know, really, a real strong support position.
I'm really digging that description.
Aren't there D-boys?
There are D-boys. D-boys are commonly known as golden retrievers. The difference is a D-boy will golden retrieve, which is to stay on the phone all day long and find out what scripts everyone else has and sneak them, steal them, get them, Xerox them, somehow abscond with that script early. A D-girl is actually meant to talk comfortingly to writers.
Oh, kind of nurse.
Nurse, exactly. There's a nursing component in the female aspect of
it. And you can add that D-boys also, if you throw a script into a swimming pool, they will actually jump in. And grab onto that with their teeth.
But what a D-girl will do is a D-girl will ask the person who threw the script to dinner. Flirt with him through the entire dinner until he jumps in the pool to retrieve the script himself.
Well, the possibilities have my mind reeling. Bruce Wagner's new novel is I'm Losing You. Linda Obst is the author of Hello, He Lied. We'll hear more from them in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Hollywood Part 2. We continue our conversation with producer Linda Obst and writer Bruce Wagner. They both have new books about the movie industry. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews First Band on the Moon by the alternative rock band The Cardigans. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. My guests are film producer Linda Obst and screenwriter and novelist Bruce Wagner. Both have new books out about Hollywood. We were talking earlier about Hollywood jargon. In Wagner's book, celebrities who test positive for AIDS are called HIVIPs. I just couldn't believe that he made up that term.
In doing research for the book, there's a large section of the book where that deals with an old talk show of washed up, one of the early talk show hosts on television who had a heart attack and smoked crack and all that stuff and detoxed in the Midwest and now is back in Los Angeles trying to get on his feet. And what he does is he sells life insurance policies of the dying, people who have AIDS. This is a real industry. Can be paid 60 cents on the dollar up front as an advance.
You didn't make this up?
No, I didn't make this up. Nothing in the book is made up. You can get an advance if you have life insurance and you're dying. You don't have to be dying of AIDS. There is an industry, a viatical industry, they call it, viatical settlement industry, where you can get an advance so you can spend money before you die.
Mm.
So I interviewed and established relationships with people that were HIV positive, one of whom was a woman named Roxy Ventola, who has since died. And Roxy was an AIDS activist and lived in Venice on a street that she called Dead Meat Street because there were so many people that were HIV positive that lived on that street. Roxy was a writer that used to work for Norman Lear, and she at one time made a joke. I think she was sort of competitive with Elizabeth Glazer and made a joke that that Elizabeth was much more of an HIVIP than she was. It was kind of a throwaway, you know, and so I picked up on that. I had to, you know, obviously I had to be extremely authentic and careful about about every aspect of the book when I discussed things gay or, I mean, someone said that I sort of was an equal opportunity writer in the way that I had sort of savaged all of these classes of people. That wasn't my goal, but I knew that I absolutely had to be spot on and authentic and specific when dealing with this large section of the book that's about AIDS. So that's where that came from. It came from Roxy Ventola.
Mm-hmm.
More jargon questions for you. NBF, new best friend. What's
Bruce
that?
Bruce and me. It's Bruce and me. Here
it's
we are.
Before our eyes.
No, NBFWC, new best friend with collagen.
And with collagen, and I'm sans collagen, as it were.
Sans
collagen.
I know him. He's at Universal, sans collagen.
Yeah, I'm actually going to have lunch with him today. The thing about NBFs is that in Hollywood, everyone is everyone's new best friend. A new best friend is a strategically placed friend. In this case, obviously, Bruce across the table from me. But a new best friend is someone who's good for your career, is someone who's good for your profile. It's a friend as an accessory. It's a friend as an accoutrement, a friend as a perk, as it were. And I talk about how difficult it is to distinguish the exhilarating NBFs from genuine friends who prove their loyalty over time from logo to logo, or what I call fake quasi-friends. Temporary allies, fake quasi-friends. NBFs become fake quasi-allies. And how you turn a
FQAs.
Fake... how you turn an FQA into a genuine A to become a real friend is serving the test of time.
If an NBF has an MBA, then actually your chances are much higher. If you're on QVC, if you're on QVC together.
And you sign the CAA.
But, you know, hey, Linda, we should do a spinoff of Friends called New Best Friends.
NBF.
Wouldn't that be cool?
It's true.
God, I think that's a hit. Who can we get on the phone now?
I think, once again, could do a call-in. We could do a pitch call-in. I think we could sell NBFs right now. First of all, we should call my brother at Endeavor. I think they could set this up at the network right away. It is a really good idea.
I want a credit in this.
I think this is good for your show.
You can be associate producer.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Oh, already she doesn't like the credit, you see? That was my first credit on Flashdance. Did you hear me complaining? Yes, by the way, is the answer to that.
We can auction off a pitch on this show.
That's a really good
idea.
I
love that.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Obst and Bruce Wagner are my guests. Linda Obst is the head of Linda Obst Production.
Coincidentally.
What?
Coincidentally. Sorry, Barbara.
That's okay. Her new film is slated for December release. It's One Fine Day, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney. And Linda has written a new book about survival in the movie business. It's called Hello, He Lied. Bruce Wagner is a screenwriter and novelist. His screenplays include scenes from The Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, Wild Palms, and Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
His and he's also chief financial officer of Linda Obst Productions.
Oh, Bruce, your new novel about the seedier side of life in Hollywood is I'm Losing You.
I Linda, love NBF. I'm so excited about NBF, the series.
Yeah.
It's really good. Wow. And at the end of each show, you actually sandbag the new best friend and have to start all over again. So you set it up. You're kind of crazy about each other in the beginning. You get the second act crisis where your agendas conflict. And by the end, you dump the new best friend and you have to make another one for the next show.
It's constant fair weather.
It is.
Friends.
That's right. And if it doesn't advantage your agenda, you move on.
Bruce.
Scintillating. Yes.
I feel you haven't talked enough, and I'd like to go
no one's
back.
Ever said that about me.
A little bit in our story. I'm going to ask you some more questions about how you got back to Hollywood after you left. We kind of left you hanging.
Well, you know, I didn't stray too far. I was in San Francisco for a while, and you know, I was always a writer. You know, as a boy, I was stealing books from bookstores. I had an enormous collection of stolen books, and I was obsessed with the French writers, with the Russian writers, and then it's almost as if I went to sleep for a while. And then when I awakened, I was writing. I met a woman who was an actress, and we began to write little movies together. And suddenly, I was off and running, getting amounts of money for movies that were not enormous, but for someone that had been driving limousines or working as a paramedic in the days before paramedics made any kind of money, it was significant amounts for me. It was almost like it was kind of like a pimp role. You would get large amounts of money, and that would last you for 6 months, and then you would sell some inconsequential movie idea. You'd pitch something, and then you'd get another wad to last you another 6 months. It was tremendously unsatisfying. And I think eventually I just was utterly compelled to write prose as a way to be alone and to have no one collaborate with me, to not be sitting opposite anyone in an executive capacity who was telling me what their idea of what I should be writing was.
Hollywood insiders Linda Obst and Bruce Wagner are my guests. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film producer Linda Obst and writer Bruce Wagner. What I have the most trouble understanding about the movie business is, and this occurs when I'm watching big flops like Waterworld or Ishtar or Robin Hood or that pirate movie.
Waterworld did $300 million worldwide. I hardly call it a big flop. I was a script doctor on that, and I resent very much that
Waterworld broke even. You have to do is run into someone from
Waterworld.
Oh, now we're getting into semantics. As far as I was concerned,
we're getting into spin.
Okay.
You said Waterworld broke water.
Anyway, movies
stillborn,
that
but broke water
so bad that they don't even really make sense as you're watching them. I'm thinking, how could so many people spend so much money and go so wrong? So help me here. How do flops happen?
It's really easy because you picked examples that all almost have the same explanation. And I don't mean to say Kevin Costner, but what you have in all those cases is a concept with a movie star that's committed a slot and a studio so committed to having a tent pole, what they call either a summer or a winter tent pole, a film that they can devise their whole schedule around, that they commit that film to production before, once again, the script is really there, before, once again, the film has justified itself as a green-lightable film, because the elements are so attractive, the Kevin Costner, the having it out for Christmas, certain aspects of the situation are so compelling to studios, they can't say no, they start committing money too early, too quickly, before the quality of the piece is assured, and so they have to keep throwing money at it. Robin Hood was in a race with another Robin Hood. They wanted to have the Kevin Costner Robin Hood. They were going to throw as much money at that Robin Hood as they possibly could to devise a surefire way of getting that film out in their release schedule.
That is sort of a revolutionary concept, throwing money at Robin Hood.
In Hollywood would they get it so backwards.
Movies are, it's like anything else. There's so many movies made
give
a year.
Give to the rich and take from the poor.
If you look in the paper, I mean, every once in a while, the LA Times, there'll be a big page that says restaurant closures, vermin infested, this or that, or all the therapists that were busted because they were prescribing drugs to patients or having sex with patients. I mean, movies are made by all kinds of people, and they're made usually for venal reasons. And most movies are bad because it is difficult to make a good movie. It's difficult to write a good book. It's difficult to do anything in a good way. You know, I mean, most people are not even thoughtful about what they're doing, regardless if they have a good material or not. Sometimes, you can see a movie and you see, well, this is a movie. It's been thoughtfully executed, even though it's not, let's say, a great script, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But people, they fall down on that level. So it's not surprising. To me, it's surprising that there is like three or four movies a year that you're really moved by.
Every studio head that I'm friendly with has the same complaint. If you have a little martini, 2 minutes later, you get the same remark from every single studio head. They have to make 8 to 10 pictures a year, and they maybe read 3 or 4 really good scripts. And they just can't. Now, that doesn't mean all of the writers out there are so frustrated that their really good script hasn't gotten to the table where these guys can see them. That's part of the frustration. And the other part of the frustration is that a really good script is a really rare thing. And it's only a small part of the equation that functions on the execution and packaging of really good scripts. Those are the easy movies to mount. But what do you do the rest of the time? When you know you have to have a Christmas picture, when you know you have to have a summer picture, when you know you have what they call this hungry animal, this distribution apparatus. It always sounded phallic to me, this distribution apparatus to feed.
Well, then you do Independence Day and Twister and
that's right,
Blockbuster.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you see those movies.
Concept movies.
To me, those movies, though, they're thoughtfully done. I mean, I don't have a problem with epic, big blockbuster movies that are lousy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I dug Independence Day. Regardless of all this pretentious carping from people that that I know. I mean, I liked it because it was not. It makes no bones to be Secrets and Lies. Mm-hmm. It's like I read the Jurassic Park sequel. Mm-hmm. They're building a whole section, part of the set at Universal Studios that they're going to use for the attraction. Mm-hmm. Like that's 5 years down the line. Mm-hmm.
It's bold marketing.
Bold and bald faced. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about New Best Friends. To me, the scary thing is the New Best Film syndrome, mm-hmm. where movies that come out that people are raving about because there is such an absence of material that a new independent film comes out or a new movie that comes out that's sort of fake on the edge, and people are just they're up in arms. This is masterful. This is extraordinary, and it's really awful.
Like what?
Well, you see,
we're going to get somebody in trouble.
Yes,
Bruce.
You see, I'm like, I have to be careful because I'm, he's someone said he's the guy that hacks off the hand that feeds him.
So forget Bite.
Yeah. No, but that's to me more dangerous. It's easy to trash a movie like Twister. Mm-hmm. And it's harder to trash and maybe there's no reason to trash a movie that comes along that was made for $1 million where people had the best intentions, but it is awful. Mm-hmm. I would rather not trash either of them. What's the point?
Bruce, you've lived in Hollywood all your life. You've grown up around stars. And Linda, you've worked with so many famous movie stars. Michelle Pfeiffer, you call Robert Redford Bob in your book. Now, honestly,
the most pretentious thing that I did in the whole book, can't you think?
Do you ever stop being fascinated by movie stars?
Oh, yes. wouldn't you say?
And Bruce, I'm thinking of something you said in an interview about going out to dinner with your agent, who is Judith Kranz's son, Tony. And you're at Mr. Chow's, which I gather is a Hollywood hotspot. And Larry Flint is there in a gold-plated wheelchair. And there was Robert Evans and his son and Billy Wilder and his group. And you said to your agent, "This is as good as it gets."
It was Larry Flint that made you think that, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, for me, once again, when I drove an ambulance, I drove Larry Flint to Martin Luther King Hospital for physical therapy. Mm. I mean, I have a really complicated history with this town.
You're Forrest Gump.
Yeah,
I am
Forrest Gump.
The dark side.
I've interfaced with so many of these people in kind of a mundane fashion. So for me, the celebrities, there is no barrier. I'm not impressed with celebrities. I was impressed early on when I would meet certain writers. You know, that was when I was 16. You know, I was near vomiting when I met Henry Miller. But then you reach a certain point where you're not. I mean, celebrities were the currency of growing up for me. My good buddy was John Barrymore III. I mean, these are the people I grew up around. Dino Martin used to rev his Ferrari by the playground of my elementary school during lunchtime. You know, those are what my memories are, you know.
To me, a celebrity is Brooks Robinson from the Baltimore Orioles. Now, that would sort of set me back. I would be unable to speak, you know.
You go. For a fuzzy guy like me, celebrities are the ultimate new best friends.
Celebrities are. When they're friends, they're new best friends. They're definitive NBFs. They're best friends for a show, right? And then when you see them at a party and they still remember your name, it's
wow.
It's quite a thrill, Bruce.
It doesn't get any
better. It doesn't get any better than that. It doesn't.
Now, Bruce, you can just sit for a moment.
I like that, like a golden retriever.
And there's a script at Paramount we're wondering if you could fetch for us. It's kind of a nightmare in Elmy Street meets
Elmy.
He's Gidget kind of a deal.
I have to ask you this question. Someone else wanted to know. We were laughing about the title of your book, "Hello, We Lied," and the idea of a culture endemic with lies. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what one of the biggest lies you had to tell in the making of a movie was.
The check is in the mail. No, they're the standard, you know, classic lies that I ever had to tell. Well, the kinds of baby lies that producers have to tell all the time. I mean, you have, of course, your sweet white lies, which is, he really liked your reading for that part. And if you had been available and if we didn't have these scheduling conflicts, of course, you'd get the part. Now, that's systemic lying. That's everyday lying. That's the white lying that you do to maintain your relationship with an actor for another day. You know, not to say that was a lousy reading and the director thought you were terrible.
Even though they don't believe you, right? I mean, everyone knows you're lying.
They want to believe you. You know, they want to believe you. And so that's the little grace that lives here. Ah, you may be lying, but I don't want to know you're lying. So I'd like to believe you're telling the truth, so I'm going to buy what you're saying. And there are strategic lies.
Boom, boom, boom. This would be a great game show, Hollywood game show.
The biggest Hollywood. Lie boom, you told boom, today. Boy, I think I'm bad at this, figuring out my lie part. Either I block it or those are the sort of, you know, we do the everyday endemic white lies. We do the discounting of the agent lies, which are, you know, those are Sandra Bullock is attached to this, Bruce Willis is attached to this, which means maybe their D-girl might have read the script. So that you have to do the normal subtraction of hype and nonsense from what you're being told. I have a certain kind of systematic fibbing about my constant scheduling and rescheduling. When a more important lunch comes along, sometimes I have to cancel a less important lunch and I can pretend that I'm out of town. I hate to admit that on the air, but that's a classic Hollywood kind of. And that's you're in the tradition of white lying to maintain relationships. Those are the ones I allow myself to tell. And then, of course, you get the calls from the agents every day with a list of possible casting ideas. And you can get the worst casting ideas ever. And you say, interesting. I'll talk to the director about that. No. And you know damn well you're not going to talk to
the director. I was supposed to have lunch with Linda after the show, but she said that she has to suddenly go to Aspen. Now, I prefer to believe that and hope to reschedule. But I've been told by Linda's office that she's going to be in Denmark for like 6 weeks. I prefer to believe that and hope to reschedule.
It kind of works like that, Barbara.
Well, I'm happy for both of you. Thanks very much, Bruce Wagner and Linda Obst. Linda's new movie, due out in December, is One Fine Day with Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney. Her memoir is called Hello, He Lied. Bruce Wagner's new novel about Hollywood culture is I'm Losing You. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new release by The Cardigans. This is Fresh Air. The latest rock and roll invasion from overseas is coming from Sweden. Most famous for giving us ABBA 20 years ago, Sweden is now the birthplace for alternative rock bands such as Salt, Blythe, and rock critic Ken Tucker's favorite, The Cardigans. The group has just released their second album called First Band on the Moon.
The thin, aching voice of Cardigans lead singer Nina Pearson is at once this band's most notable sound and its most clever decoy. Pearson sounds delicate and vulnerable singing the band's delicate, vulnerable melodies. But unlike other Swedish pop acts like ABBA or the more recent Ace of Base and Roxette, there's a darker side to the Cardigans that comes out in the lyrics. Listen to a catchy song like this one, and you may not even realize that it's about a woman declaring an angry independence from a guy who's used her in ways that she's sick of. Baby boy, your face is pretty and your life's a toy. Master man, I'm never better than your latest plan. Poor Tony. What are you gonna try to be? Where are you gonna go without me now? I've been your mother, I've been your father. Who can ask me for more? I've been your sister, I've been your mistress. Maybe I was your whore. Who can ask me for more? Pearson writes most of the songs for the Cardigans with lead guitarist Peter Svensson. For all the easy-listening smoothness of their material, they're certainly not naive musicians. The group taps into the current revival of quick, melodic punk music and the cult for what's known as lounge music. The Cardigans transcend trendiness to create striking songs such as this lovely bit of Beatlesque pop describing a creepily masochistic relationship. It's called Step On Me. Most of the music on First Band on the Moon is like this, light and airy and intricate. You'd be hard-pressed to hear the influence that heavy metal has had on the Cardigans. But read interviews with the band and you find out that when they first got together in 1993, they were real hard rockers. Why, Peter Svensson even has a tattoo on his arm of Ace Frehley, guitarist for Kiss. On their previous album, the Cardigans offered a jaunty cover of Black Sabbath's Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. On this album, they've deconstructed another Sabbath tune, Iron Man, rendering it delightfully unrecognizable. Cardigans are doing everything possible to hit it big in the States. Nina Pearson's impeccable English does away with any possible language barrier, and she and Svensson are writing songs that ought to stick in the brain pan of any open-minded listener. I'd say it's high time to try these Cardigans on for size.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Raley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
A common line. I closed my eyes, but couldn't. Perfect time, I dropped my guard and lost but one somehow. Is Robert sad? It feels like we've never made it together since. One word.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.